Okay, so two key items here from the vocabulary list that we did not cover the other day from Washington's presidency. Well, we did cover the Jay Treaty. We need to talk about Washington's farewell address. Anybody know why that particular farewell address? I think out of all the presidents, there's only two presidents whose farewell address we talk about. One's George Washington. Anybody know who the other one is?
Abraham.
No, he didn't give a farewell. Well, you know, the closest thing that Abraham Lincoln gave to a farewell address was the second inaugural, which, you know, that's given in late March. You know, so that's mere weeks before his assassination. And I would argue to you is superior to the Gettysburg Address. When you go to the Lincoln Memorial and you look on the wall, you've got the Gettysburg Address on one side on the wall, and you've got the second inaugural. The second inaugural, we will read that together. It's the shortest inaugural address in presidential history, and I would argue, you know, the best. It's a masterpiece. But back to farewell addresses. Washington's farewell address, which is the other one that we remember? It's very often quoted. It's a modern president, post-World War II.
Reagan?
Huh? No. It's Eisenhower's. Eisenhower's farewell address just kind of stunned the nation because it was a warning about the growing military-industrial complex and how it had seized control of our national government. That was in 1950, that would have been in 1960 he gave that address. And 53 years later, everything about his prophecy has come true. So that one is frequently used. The fact that Eisenhower was a five-star general, conservative Republican, also underscores, okay, yes, even Eisenhower thought he thought we had gone too far in 1960, and look at where we are today. What does Washington say in his farewell address? What's the warning?
To stay
neutral. It tends to get condensed down to that, but that's not exactly what he says. He does talk about parties. Permanent alliances. So let's stay with that. There's a difference between staying neutral and not having permanent alliances. What's the difference? Well, why no permanent, or to use the term, entangling alliances? What's the danger of having an entangling or permanent alliance? Exactly. Thank you very much. So when if you're allied with country X and they're sucked into a war, you have already predetermined that you are now following country X into war, regardless if that's in the national interest, the national security interest of the United States. When does the United States make its first permanent entangling alliance? NATO. Good. NATO breaks precedent. Washington is quoted over and over and over. You know, and Jefferson makes a similar plea as well. No permanent or entangling alliances. Okay. Next thing here. Okay. The XYZ affair. So we talked the other day about the Jay Treaty and how that had hurt the feelings of the French. In order to mitigate, to make up for the hurt feelings with the French, John Adams, in his presidency, is going to dispatch a delegation of diplomats to go hopefully meet with Prime Minister Talleyrand in France. Instead of that happening, instead of Talleyrand coming out to meet the American delegation, instead of that happening, they send out three flunkies, three nobodies, that the American press are going to refer to as Mr. X, Mr. Y, and Mr. Z. So that's how the event becomes known as the XYZ affair. And what is it that Mr. X, Mr. Y, and Mr. Z demand of the American delegation before Talleyrand will deign to meet with them?
A bribe.
A bribe, okay. The $250,000 or so dollar bribe. We don't have it. We're not going to pay it. What's the headline in the newspapers back here in the United States? What's the famous slogan that comes out of the XYZ affair? We thump our chests. Millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. Millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. Tribute being bribe money. We won't pay any bribe money to France. By God, we will build up our military if that's what it takes. So the XYZ affair further frosts relations between the United States and France, and is going to lead into this undeclared naval war that we're going to have with France in the Caribbean, the so-called quasi-war. Starts 1798, undeclared naval war for control of the Caribbean. U.S. forces seize 93 French privateers. Okay, again, those are licensed pirates. We lose just one ship. So it's more of a nuisance than it is a serious matter, but it could always escalate. Anything like this can always escalate. And Adams is concerned that the nation could tip into war either with France or with Britain. The Federalists, of course, basically say, let's go to war with France, let's have an all-out war with France, let's get this over with, and we ought to really be forming our natural alliance with Great Britain. They're our natural ally. After all, they are our intellectual and blood ancestors. The Democratic Republicans, the Jefferson's crowd, many of them are of the opposite persuasion. Yes, we need to go to war. We need to go to war against Great Britain, our natural ally intellectually in terms of liberty and equality is France. And if we would go to war against Great Britain once and for all, we would have our permanent natural alliance with France. So I think most historians place Adams in a similar position as George Washington, as trying to straddle between those two extreme poles, to try to not listen to the extremes of his own party, the Federalists, who are clamoring for war with France, and to certainly then rebuff the moves of the Democratic Republicans who want to go to war against Great Britain. And it's out of that balancing act that the Alien and Sedition Acts arise, which there are four laws that are passed in the Alien and Sedition Acts. It's not just one thing. It's four separate laws. There are the Sedition Act, which is going to make it a federal crime to criticize American foreign policy, especially to criticize it in print. That's the Sedition Act. And then there are the Alien Acts. There are three of those. And basically the sum total of the Alien Acts is to make it harder for new people to come into the country and to make it easier to get rid of some of the ones that are already here and to extend the length of time you have to be here in order to be able to vote. The three Alien Acts taken together, the goal is to diminish the increasing power of the Democratic Republicans, the Jeffersonians, the pro-French crowd, because the immigrants who are coming in are typically pro-French, they are pro-Jefferson, they are pro-Democratic Republican. So the Sedition Act, the Alien Acts are aimed at them. So the Democratic Republicans are going to see these acts as being purely political. It's not really national security interests, President Adams, that you care about. you're passing these laws, you're signing the laws passed by your Federalist majority in order to try to strangle us, to remove us from any chance of having power. Adams' response and his apologists throughout history, that no, it really wasn't done for political reasons. It was all these laws were passed for reasons of national security. They are still the Alien Sedition Acts because of things that will come like them later. The Sedition Act that is passed early in World War One, and we will be locking up newspaper editors during World War One. And then, of course, what's the law on the books today that's so controversial that we say has been passed for reasons of national security? Passed just days after 9/11. The Patriot Act. Okay. So Adams has taken it on the chin for two centuries now, and that argument's still going on as to what, and it's a fascinating argument, but we'll get it more into that on Monday. Okay, so that brings us up then to the election or so-called revolution of 1800 between Adams and Jefferson. Adams, the Federalist, Jefferson now, the leader of this Republican Party, not to be confused with today's Republican Party. It's a nasty election. I can't remember the nastiness directed at Adams, but I know that Jefferson's surrogates are out there doing it. Abigail Adams will never forgive Thomas Jefferson for the trash that was hurled at her husband. She never gets over it. The Adams surrogates, his crowd, are the first ones that start to spread the rumor that Jefferson is sleeping with a slave and has fathered children with her. Jefferson at the time, his surrogates are denying this, but Adams makes the point, which I think is an important point, that it doesn't really matter if it's true or not. What matters is that in the situation of slavery, a female slave has no protection from rape. You know, and if that's the part of the evil institution of slavery. Adams, really the only president in the first seven not to be a slave owner. And it's going to be his son, John Quincy Adams, if you want to really get back to the beginning of the abolitionist movement, John Quincy Adams is right there. What's so important about this election? What's the big deal? What's the key significance of the election of 1800? It's the most important word there on that slide. Peacefully. Yeah. That's the most important word. Because so often, when there is a handoff of power from one faction to another faction in any government, what tends to follow that transfer of power? Well, or violence. Okay. Violence follows it. We can't live, the other side can't live with the new side who has come in power. Very often it's revolution that created the transfer of power. But what that so often happens is that revolution gives birth to counter-revolution, which gives birth to counter-revolution. And it just, you know, this is so much the history of Latin America. You know, not having a peaceful handoff of power. So it is a big deal when the Federalists hand off power to the Democratic Republicans and there isn't violence. Have we ever had an election in the United States, a presidential election, that created violence? Lincoln? Yeah, Lincoln's election creates a little bit of violence. 2% of the population will be killed as a result of that election. So that's not a peaceful transfer of power. there will be one side in the American body politic that will not live with that election, won't abide it. Haven't had anything as contentious since. It's been contentious. You know, you when George W. Bush won the Supreme Court case and a virtue of winning the Supreme Court case in 2000 took office, his limousine was egged on the parade route. They had to stop the parade. And then, of course, there are a fair chunk of Americans that don't believe that Barack Obama is a legitimate president, that he's not an American citizen, and has no rightful place being in the White House. But it hasn't spawned violence. Jefferson and Adams, my guess is you probably learned in the first semester, after Jefferson's presidency, they do patch things up. And they carry on a spirited correspondence till the day they die. And those letters are easily accessible in one bound volume. And it's a fascinating look at their thoughts. And they, of course, they know that they're writing for future generations. But you have two sharp minds. You know, the two chief collaborators, Adams and Jefferson, are the two top collaborators on the writing of the Declaration of Independence. It's quite a fascinating couple. When do they die?
July 4th.
July 4th. What year? 1826. 50 years after the signing. And Adams's last words? Jefferson survives. That's good stuff. I mean, Steven Spielberg couldn't have written that. Okay, but John Adams did.
Why didn't Jefferson die on Sunday?
They did die. Well, you know, they didn't have text messages, and they didn't know that he did. Jefferson was already dead.
Oh.
So I think Adams outlasted him by a couple of hours. It does lead to the 12th Amendment of Burr, the Federalist, becomes, you see, you ran the president and vice president at the time did not run as a unified ticket, so Jefferson is stuck with the Federalist and the opportunist Aaron Burr. Okay, so what's going to be different about Jefferson's government compared to his predecessors? He's still going to talk a good game of limited government. He's going to try to stick to his Republican principles. I would say one of the big things he's going to do is, it's not that the army is huge at the time, but he's going to reduce the size of it. Again, a consistent Republican principle. They're opposed to standing armies. They're costly. Because they're costly, that means you've got to raise taxes. If you're going to raise taxes, you need a powerful central government. If you have a powerful central government, they're going to end up taking away other liberties. Therefore, we don't want a standing army. Plus, if you have a standing army, that standing army could take over. That's another reason not to have a standing army. If you have a large standing army, you're going to have a temptation to want to use it to try to subjugate other peoples. And so for a variety of reasons, the Jeffersonians are opposed to a large standing army. This is going to cause them problems because both Jefferson and his protege and future president Madison are opposed to large standing armies, but yet they like to thump their chests. And Madison's going to thump his chest, and he's going to get us into a war with Great Britain after the army and the navy have been reduced to nothing. and they're going to count on militia. And militia is not an effective fighting force for any length of time.
What exactly is protege?
Does what?
Protege.
Protege, you are my student with great promise. A protege. It's age. It's age. And I don't know about social class, but they're good friends. Their protege is probably a little over the top because, to take your point, they are intellectual equals. And they're also fairly close in age, but one does have power and prominence first. Dolly and James had their own room at Monticello to stay at. That's how close the Madisons and the Jeffersons were. And just, again, it's another one of those time machine things. I want to go back there and just kind of be sitting in a corner while Madison and Jefferson are playing chess and drinking Madeira. And listen to that conversation. Just to be in the room for 30 minutes. That would be awesome. Okay. Let's talk about land and a relationship to democracy. I think this is a key principle. It's one that you have got to internalize to understand American history from the early colonial period all the way up through the closing of the frontier in, say, the 1870s, 1880s. If you're a Jeffersonian, your independence is tied to your ability to own land. If you don't own land, you're really not a complete human being. More importantly, you're not a complete citizen. The movie Far and Away really underscores that dynamic. You're just not anybody unless you own land. Jefferson, that's one of the reasons Jefferson wants to reach out and grab this Louisiana territory. It gives the United States permanent access to the Mississippi River, which if you're a farmer in Tennessee or in Kentucky or later on Arkansas, Mississippi, is vital. You can't ship your stuff to the rest of the world without access to the Mississippi River. And access to the Mississippi River rises and falls on whoever controls the port of New Orleans. So, plus, that would give the United States a whole bunch of farmland if we were able to acquire the territory. Now, when Jefferson is originally out to acquire Louisiana, he's not out to acquire that huge chunk of land that we call Louisiana Purchase. He's more or less looking for what is now present-day Louisiana, not the rest of it. How does he end up getting that? France had gotten this land from Spain with Spain's understanding that if Napoleon were to ever try to dispose of it, that they would have the first chance to reclaim it. Why is Napoleon looking to get rid of Louisiana? He needs cash. He had looked to reestablish a colony, a major colony there in the territory. He had sent one of his top armies, but his army stopped off someplace on the way. Where did Napoleon's army stop off on the way to Louisiana? Yeah, where? You stop off in modern-day Haiti. What's going on in Haiti at the time? There's a slave revolt. And so the army's job was to put down the slave revolt. Hey, it's just a slave revolt. How hard can that be? Okay, well, unfortunately for Napoleon's men, they didn't have resistance to malaria. and the slaves did. Okay, so that combined with the fact that the slaves were pretty well organized and led by a very charismatic figure by the name of Toussaint. Toussaint decimates Napoleon's army, and what's left of it limps back to France. Plus, the French Revolution said, you know, maybe, you know, slavery isn't a really good thing, and so they let Haiti go. Now Napoleon needs cash because he's gearing up for war once again with Great Britain. Jefferson had sent a diplomat by the name of Livingston to negotiate for the Louisiana Territory. Livingston was prepared to offer, I believe, $10 million for Louisiana. And Napoleon counters, I won't sell you Louisiana for $10 million, but I will sell you this whole huge chunk of land for $15 million. And recognizing the deal, Livingston says, sure, we'll take that off your hands for $15 million. Now, we didn't have the $15 million. Ironic question, where did we get the money from? Again, I said it was an ironic question. Huh? No. We get the money from Britain. Okay, so we borrow money from Britain to buy Louisiana. The money that we use from Britain goes to Napoleon, who is then going to use that capital to finance his next war with Britain. Okay, that's how capitalism works. As Karl Marx said, the capitalist will sell you the rope with which you can hang him. Well, first, let's say Karcher and I play some poker tonight, and he's out of money. He doesn't have anything more to bet, but he does have the deed to Pluto. Okay, and it's been given, the United Nations has signed it over to him. Here's Pluto. And so he throws that into the pot, and we play for Pluto, and I win. I've now got the deed to Pluto. Now, what good is that deed to Pluto to me? Unless I have the ability to extract resources and or to occupy it, all it is a piece of paper. So all that we really get from Louisiana, from Napoleon, is a semi-legit piece of paper. Spain isn't going to recognize it, okay? And this is important. It's why, this is what I'm telling you right here is important. It's what makes the Battle of New Orleans important. Having the piece of paper that says that you own that territory doesn't mean diddly squat unless you can occupy it and defend it. The Battle of New Orleans is what demonstrates, I don't know if they'll ever have enough people to occupy it, but they sure as hell can defend it. Okay, so there's an old saying, possession's 9/10 of the law. And that's true, going to be true here as well. Napoleon doesn't have the manpower to occupy it, to enforce it. So might as well sell it for what he can. Well, Russia had claim to it when we bought it. I don't know who. I mean, if you follow world history thought, you know, there's tremendous evidence that man, you know, migrated out of the Indus River Valley and then moves into Eastern Asia, and then from Eastern Asia walks across the frozen Bering Strait into what we call Alaska, and then comes down the West Coast. And that theory has been out there for a long time. We've been able to more or less substantiate, I don't know if you can use the word confirm, but we've been able to substantiate that theory with DNA evidence. In other words, you can take Indians of the American Southwest and compare their DNA to, say, Mongolians, and it's really close, which is pretty cool. You know, through and pretty soon, my guess is we'll have a global DNA map, and you'll be able to kind of step back from that global DNA map and figure out how early migration patterns actually worked. And that'll be cool. Other questions? Okay. This is there's an interesting point here about Jefferson buying the Louisiana Territory, because he did not get permission from Congress to do this. He has violated a strict interpretation of the Constitution. Congress has the checkbook, not the executive. How does he get away with it? How come he's not impeached? Jesse's dad leaves her the Amex card for emergencies over the weekend. Don't spend any more than $100, he says, as he walks out the door. Okay. 3 hours later, a guy driving a huge semi-truck full of brand new Ferraris stops by Jesse's house and says, "I will sell you this brand new Ferrari for $4,000. Do you happen to have any credit cards? As a matter of fact, my dad left me his Amex. Do you take Amex?" He says, "Sure." And he's got the little swiper on top of his iPhone, and he swipes Daddy's Amex card and gives you the keys to the red Ferrari on the back of the truck. Okay, how come Jesse's father doesn't beat her when he comes home? It was a hell of a deal. Okay, so that's why Jefferson is not impeached. You doubled the size of the United States without firing a shot, without losing one drop of blood, for 3.5 cents an acre. You know what, Tom? You're okay. You're all right, Tom. That's how he gets away with it. So that there's another lesson there. Presidents can do impeachable things and not be impeached, because Jackson's going to do it all day long if the American population goes along with it. Okay, I was convinced. I mean, I'm a reader of history, deeply cynical. I was convinced George W. Bush was going to get impeached for, you know, this eavesdropping that he was doing without any congressional authority, without any congressional oversight, with no court oversight, eavesdropping on millions of Americans. I figured after Watergate, you know, this would be it would have been a slam dunk. It wasn't even brought up. That's how terrified we were of terrorists. Okay, I don't care if he's listening in without warrants to people's telephone conversations, said the vast majority of Americans. I'm more afraid of terrorists than I am of George W. Bush listening in to me talk. So, nothing was said. John Marshall. I'm not going to go into his individual court cases. Hopefully those were drilled in your head in AP government or civics class. Look at how long he's on the bench. He's the third Chief Justice, but look, he's on the bench for 35 years. When you go to the Supreme Court, and I'll show you this in the next slide, you walk down the main hallway of the Supreme Court, there's a little plaster bust of every single justice who's ever sat on the court. And I'm walking down the hallway, and I'm looking for John Marshall. And I can't find my man. So I go back to the beginning of the hallway, and I'm going back down both sides of the hallway. All these busts are kind of inset, shadow box style into the wall. You know, little light on them, and then little thing about what they had done. And I can't find John Marshall. How can this be the Supreme Court, and you don't have... Where's your John Marshall? Oh, okay. You got to go around the corner, and there's John Marshall. What do you need to know about his decisions? Pardon me? I'll show you. I found the photograph. Marshall's decisions, the common thread is, if there is a conflict between the federal and the state government, who's going to win? The federal government. The Federalist Party has disappeared. They have left the building after the War of 1812. They are thoroughly discredited. They disappear as a party in 1815, 1816. But John Marshall was on that bench until 1835. You got kids growing up that never ever saw, voters growing up who never saw a Federalist. And John Marshall is still on the bench writing decisions. He creates the Supreme Court. Yes, it was there prior to him. He makes the Supreme Court supreme. He elevates it to a co-equal branch of government. Very much like the way that Andrew Jackson will elevate the presidency. Andrew Jackson really made the presidency the presidency. It was even under, you know, Washington and Adams and Madison, it just didn't have the oomph that Jackson brought to it. Jackson demonstrated, here's what's really what's possible to do with this office. That was Jackson's gift. And of course, it's interesting that these two, Jackson and Marshall, they will go at it. They are two titans. So, yeah, everybody else got a little plaster bust, okay, like this, like 3/4 life size. John Marshall, twice life size, full body bronze. Okay. And that's proportionately correct to his impact on the court. Everybody else is minuscule compared to John Marshall. And nobody knows who he is. If John Marshall isn't there, I don't know if you have a country. You have to know who's essential. In my book, George Washington is essential. There is no country without George Washington. He's at the top of the list. Well, who's next? I say Madison and Hamilton are tied for second. You gotta have the father of American capitalism and the father of the Constitution. Those two are essential. And then for number four, my vote's going to go to John Marshall, who nobody knows who he is. Very few people know who Hamilton is. They know he's on the $10 bill, but they don't know why. They know he got shot. They know he got shot in a duel. But they don't know.
Did he go into that duel thinking that he was actually going to
be in the duel? Well, that duel, let me take a minute to talk about that duel. It was an affair of honor. It would not have been called a duel. It was an affair of honor. And an affair of honor, these aren't rednecks going out in the woods with pistols. Affairs of honor were conducted by gentlemen. Okay? It is an activity for the American aristocracy. Okay. And it starts with an insult. Somebody said something about your family or your reputation or whatever, and then typically you ask for some sort of public apology to be printed in a newspaper. And if it's not squared away that way, then you meet on the field of honor. Okay. And what would happen 90% of the time is the person that you would have the insult with, you meet on the field of honor, you do have your dueling pistols, and you mark off the paces, and then you fire the pistol in the air, and you go off and you have a brandy together, and that's it. You have both protected your reputations, okay, and now our argument is done. to see, you have two conflicting accounts of what happened. One account of what happened there in New Jersey, opposite the shore of New York, is that both everybody agrees Hamilton fired first. What some people say is that Hamilton fired deliberately above Burr and deliberately aimed to miss. Other people say that Hamilton took the first shot and just happened to miss, but was trying to kill Burr. That's not, you know, we don't know. It's an ongoing debate. What's true about it is that what happened to Burr was so. It happened to most people who won duels. If you won a duel, you lost it. In other words, your reputation is destroyed. You've killed another human being, and since it's an affair of honor, you've killed another person of high standing. And so your standing is going to diminish tremendously. It was legal in New Jersey. It was illegal in New York. It was legal in New Jersey. People fought duels, or they had duels, or they had affairs of honor. This is what gentlemen did. Why would Barack Obama be able to go back? Or Joe Biden be able to go back and conduct the Senate after he played a round of golf? I mean, it's just to us, because we don't really understand what it is, which is a way of maintaining reputation, of maintaining your social and political standing. Now, was it more than that? Yeah, a human being died, and so. He's able to go back, but his reputation is destroyed. Hopefully we all know Marbury versus Madison, okay? The right of judicial review is strongly implied, if not explicit, in the Constitution. Marbury versus Madison removes the ambiguity. Okay, so let's talk a little bit here about the War of 1812. Again, there are two, and this has been true since the very beginning of the Republic, these two titanic European powers of Great Britain and France. And again, we are caught in between the two of them. Should we make an alliance with one or the other? Should we remain neutral? It seems that making alliance with one would mean that we would get crushed. It also seems that being neutral is also an untenable position. So it's complicated to know what to do. British Orders and Council in 1806 say that the United States ships have to have a license to be on the Atlantic. And that Great Britain reserves the right to search ships for contraband. Contraband is a generic term. Contraband is anything that you're not supposed to have. Okay? So if I look in Rachel's backpack and there's marijuana in there, that's contraband. Okay? She's got a gun in there. That's contraband. She's not allowed to have those items here at school. She might be allowed to have the gun at her house, but it's contraband here. Contraband, in the terms of under the British Orders and Council of 1806, is basically going to be anything that could possibly help France. So the British Orders and Council has got a gun pointed to her head, and here comes Napoleon, which basically says if you follow along with the British system, then we'll take your stuff. So if you're an American merchant selling your American shipper, you're stuck between Great Britain and France, and it doesn't seem like there is a position where you can succeed. Another issue that we're dealing with Great Britain, besides their forced licensing of ships and their seizing of cargo bound for France is this issue of impressment. Basically, this is where Great Britain is boarding American ships and taking American sailors off those ships and forcing them, pressing them to work into the British Navy. Great Britain justified this basically saying, yes, okay, we know you had your little war of independence, but there is no United States. Okay, remember, they just recognized the individual states. You have no national government, sir. You were born as a British subject, and you remain forever until the day you die a British subject. Therefore, we have the right, the constitutional right, to press you into His Majesty's service. Here's your swab. And if you don't want to swab the deck, then you can swim for shore. So what would happen is that you'd be pressed into service, and then when the ship would make port, you'd run away, and then that ship would have to then go out and re-kidnap another crew. If you were a young man and you lived in a port city during in a colonial period in the United States history, you were in Boston, Philadelphia, Charleston, New York would probably be the worst. And you went out and you got drunk that night, and you kind of passed out on the street, you might wake up the next morning 20 miles away from shore, because the press gangs would go out from their ship at about 1 o'clock in the morning with a cart and look for guys who were passed out and just put them on the cart and take them down to the dock and throw them on the boat and drop anchor and leave. Okay, so it was an old problem of being this compulsory naval service. Okay.
Is that just because they were pissed because we
went
still bowing down?
I think it's very pragmatic. I need bodies to help run my ship. I'm always looking for bodies.
No, I mean not the like carting people. We're
going to
search your ships.
They don't want any... A friend of my enemy is my enemy. You're helping France, you're my enemy. Okay. And all you ladies know this. You know, you and Maddie aren't friends anymore. And Jenny starts talking to Maddie, and you were friends with Jenny, but not now that she's talking to Maddie. Nope, you defriend her. She's off my Facebook page. Until she comes to her senses and defriends Maddie. And she sends you a screen capture of I defriended Maddie, and then you can be friends again. Okay? You know, it's people aren't complicated. That's not true. People are complicated, but they are... Human nature remains relatively consistent. Okay, the Leopard fires on the Chesapeake. I can't remember why the Leopard fired on the Chesapeake, the American ship, the Chesapeake, but it does. I think it just refused to be boarded. And this is going to make Americans mad. But you've got a Republican in the White House. You've got Thomas Jefferson in the White House, who, being Mr. I don't believe in a strong standing army or a strong standing navy, doesn't have a hell of a lot to fight back with. So he's going to do what Americans have always done with Great Britain when they're mad, not trade with them. Now, in the past, that had worked fairly well. Stamp tax, Townsend Acts. Okay, boycotts had their place. For some reason, and I'm not entirely sure why, this particular trade embargo is not going to work. At least it's not going to work in 1807 and 1808. It doesn't have the impact desired. I don't know if Britain's got other trading partners that can live with it at the time, But the net effect is that the embargo of 1807, most people at least at the time thought, was hurting Americans far more than it was hurting the British, with whom it was intended to punish. This is a real famous cartoon from the period. And it says, "Damn it, Howie Nixum." The other guy says, "Oh, this cursed," and can you read that? O-G-R-A-B-M-E. "Oh, this cursed Ogrebome." What is that? Read it backwards. And now why they've coded it that, why the cartoonists coded it that way, I don't know.
Was this like after the aliens
edition? Well, this is the embargo is Jefferson's response to the attack on the Chesapeake.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, yes. Maybe he did that so he wouldn't get in trouble.
Well, no, but the Alien Sedition Act's dead.
Oh.
Okay, the Alien Sedition Act's had a sunset on them, and the Republicans just allow it to die. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, the Alien Sedition Acts are gone. Except for, I did find, just recently read, that Jefferson will use the Sedition Act to lock up a couple of Federalists. Yeah. Hypocrisy in politics. Oh, that is evil Federalists. They're using it for political reasons. And now you're in the White House. Oh, I see my predecessor has left a gun for me to use. Okay. Barack Obama has been, you know, charged, I think legitimately so, with doing the same thing. He accused George W. Bush of doing some rather nasty things in the war on terror. And Barack Obama has not given up those powers. In fact, he's enlarged them. You know, you may have seen in the news yesterday the confirmation hearings for the new CIA director. And at the top of the list is, does the President of the United States have the legal authority to assassinate an American citizen on foreign soil without any type of oversight? Because this president claims he has that authority. Okay? And still hasn't even fully released the legal reasoning behind it to the intelligence community, to the committee, until yesterday. But then their staff isn't allowed to read the legal reasoning. It wasn't until night before last that we finally released, that the Obama administration finally released its reasoning behind that it's okay to assassinate American citizens on foreign soil who pose an imminent threat. And then we were asked about an imminent threat. Well, by imminent threat, you mean like that American citizen is just, you know, a hair trigger away from attacking American people or American interests. Well, no, it really turned out that imminent didn't mean imminent at all. Okay? So that's an incredible power that this president is claiming. Back to Jefferson in 1807. He's going to put the embargo on, but it doesn't do very much. Congress is going to take it away in 1809. So much of the War of 1812. Let's say today, Alex is walking down the hall, and Hope just slaps the crap out of her. I mean, just out of nowhere, Hope just belts her. Okay? And Alex, you know, Alex wants to beat you back up, but she's afraid of you. She knows that you've got a black belt in karate. Okay? She knows that you're packing heat. She knows that you've got like 10 boyfriends with assault weapons. Okay? So she, you know, she's going to defriend you on Facebook. Okay, which is just going to make you laugh more in her face, but that's the most that she can do. But what's percolating in her mind there is, eventually, I'm going to get you. Okay, when I get big and strong, and I get some boyfriends with some guns, and I get my black belt in karate, I'm going to get you. That's the War of 1812. When we go to war with Britain in 1812, we're going to war over stuff that happened 5 years earlier. But okay, now we got our army together. Now we're ready to fight. Huh? Over what? Well, you remember, you know, the Chesapeake thing. That was 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. We don't forget. Okay. I'd say that that is at least half of the War of 1812 right there. Our old grudges. Okay, we already talked about Pinckney's Treaty. There's also the Adams-Onis Treaty. I'm not sure why it wasn't on your vocabulary list here. That is going to give us Florida from Spain. It also kind of gives us Oregon. I say kind of because Great Britain is also going to claim that. And again, Oregon at the time, if I can get my pointer here, Oregon at the time went from here all the way up to here, to the 5440 line. That's not going to be settled. Oregon won't be settled truly until the middle of the Mexican-American War, when we will cut a deal with Great Britain. Okay. So how is Madison going to deal with these trade issues with France and Britain? He tries two approaches. The first one doesn't work. The second one does. Okay, so what are they? First one, the Non-Intercourse Act, which has made eighth graders giggle since it was issued, or AP students. Okay, refused. The Non-Intercourse Act says not trade, don't trade with either Britain or France until one of them takes away the trade restrictions. We're not going to trade with either one of you. We're going to maintain an embargo on both of you. Okay, so we're bringing back the embargo idea. It had been placed on Great Britain by Jefferson. Congress repealed it. Madison's bringing it back, but this time he's bringing it back on both countries. Okay, and the first one of you that's nice, then, you know, well, that'll be great. That didn't work. Nathaniel Macon from North Carolina, for whom this county is named, a Jeffersonian Republican, comes up with this slight, very clever variation. Okay, instead of doing it that way, let's trade with both of them. Whichever one of them is nicest to us first, then we will become exclusive friends with that country. We'll trade with both of them, and then whichever one finally lifts these restrictions will be exclusive to that one. That works, okay? Napoleon takes the trade restrictions off, and we've become now best buddies with France. Great Britain sees that, gets worried, takes its trade restrictions off, but we don't find out about it until 2 weeks too late, because by then we have declared war. Okay, but that's not the only reason. So, you know, causes of the War of 1812, and there are a lot of them. I think that the War of 1812, I see I've got about 15 minutes left, and I still want to talk about your body paragraphs. So I'm going to stop right there, and I'm going to hold the rest of War of 1812 until Monday. Okay, so let me stop the PowerPoint and stop Audacity.